Welcome to 30 Brave Minutes, a podcast of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of North Carolina at Pembroke. In 30 Brave Minutes, we'll give you something interesting to think about. Today's topic is presidential elections. Joining us are Dr. Mark Thompson, Dr. Emily F. Sharum, and Professor Mayor Beth Sindel. Your host for 30 Brave Minutes is Dr. Jeff Frederick, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences.
Since the adoption of the U.S. Constitution, America has had 45 presidents, if we include the soon-to-be-inaugurated Donald Trump. We've had five presidents that were not elected: John Tyler, Millard Fillmore, Andrew Johnson, Chester Arthur, and Gerald Ford. They assumed the office after either death or resignation. Some presidents have been hailed by scholars as universally great or near great. George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and Franklin Roosevelt are most mentioned in this class, largely for the precedents they created as presidents and the great crises they faced while in office. Others consistently rank at the other end of the spectrum: Andrew Johnson, James Buchanan, and Warren G. Harding, for example. We've elected Federalists and Anti-Federalists, Whigs, Republicans, and Democrats. We've seen other political parties come and go as well, like the Know-Nothings, Free Soilers, believe it or not, the Bull Mooses, and the American Socialist Party. And over the fullness of time, we've seen the process change. The first presidential candidates didn't even make speeches on their own behalf. The 2012 presidential campaign seems to have cost about $2.6 billion, and this year will probably be over $3 billion, but it's too soon to know for sure. Newspapers were intensely partisan for a while, then not so much, and now a significant portion of the consumed media has a clear perspective from one side or the other. In the end, we've turned politics into a spectator sport, merging party, media, locality, personality, constitution, and not always to the benefit of the people. Our topic for today is the changing nature of presidential elections. Mark Thompson earned his MA and PhD from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. His training is as an early American historian, and most of his research, writing, and teaching has focused on that. Since coming to UNCP, he has taught a wide variety of courses, including ones on the colonial and revolutionary periods, American military history, North Carolina history, U.S. foreign policy, and war in American society. Good afternoon, Mark. How did the founding generation conceive of the presidency?
Well, I think it's fair to say that the founding generation and the delegates at the Constitutional Convention had very mixed feelings about the presidency. After all, they had just finished a war of independence that was driven in part by their conviction that they had been abused by the British monarch, who used his power to their detriment, and so they weren't at all excited about creating a strong executive who might do the same to them. On the other hand, the delegates to the Constitutional Convention were there in part because the current U.S. government, the Confederation government, as it was called, was very weak and ineffective in many ways. It had no executive branch. It, in fact, had no independent judicial branch, and all power flowed through a Confederation Congress that also had very limited powers. So they knew they wanted an executive, but they didn't agree on how much power that executive should have. They didn't agree on who should elect him and how long he should serve, and they adjusted to that over time. The modern presidency really took many decades to emerge. I'd also add that there are two other issues that I think were really influential in these early elections, and they involve two things that today we assume are essential parts of the political process, but that generation was very ambivalent about. And those two things are democracy and political parties. Most Americans of the early national period knew they wanted a republic, which means they wanted some democracy, but they didn't agree on how much democracy, how much they wanted to entrust the reins of power to the common people. Historically, in the colonial period, politics was the province of a colonial elite, people who had the most education, owned the most land, had the most experience, and they were very reluctant to involve the common people who they thought were too irrational and too fickle, too inexperienced and too uneducated. And that ambivalence is reflected in the government created by the delegates to the Constitutional Convention. They created a president, but he would not be elected by the people. They created that odd little institution, the Electoral College. And likewise with the Senate, the members of the Senate were not elected by the people for the first 100 years of U.S. history. So they were ambivalent about democracy. And likewise, they were ambivalent about political parties. The first political parties in American history emerged during the administration of George Washington, and George Washington, in his farewell address, warned Americans to beware the perils of political parties or factions. And they generally assumed that in a republic, people had to be virtuous, and by that they meant they had to be willing to subordinate their own interests to the interests of the nation. And the appearance of political parties sort of suggested that the members of those parties were not pursuing the interests of the nation, but the interests of those party members. There were people like James Madison who embraced political parties, but Americans were very reluctant to see them appear and only embrace them very slowly.
Emily Neff-Shirum is an associate professor in American politics and public policy. Her interests focus on women in politics and policies that affect women. She is currently chair of the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UNCP. Welcome, Emily. Emily, even as America over time has added more folks to the voting process, women, people under the age of 18, minorities, not everyone has chosen to participate in voting. Why?
Well, part of that is a story of socialization. So what we find is that women work really, really hard for the right to vote. In 1920, when they are able to secure that right to vote, we have a couple of elections in which they are very robust voters and they turn out quite a bit. And then there's a huge falling off period. And part of that is that women had just not been socialized and did not see it as an important piece of their day-to-day lives. But we see a resurgence that happens. So it may take time for folks to become see voting as a normalized part of their process. And so by the 1980s, we start to see the development of the gender gap, where women do turn out to vote in significant ways. Part of that is getting accelerated today as both the political parties are trying to bring in new cohorts of voters in order to get the upper hand. And we see a lot of that discussion right now with immigrants and the idea of trying to secure the Latino vote to be either a Democratic bloc or a Republican bloc. And there's a lot of discussion around that. And so part of that is motivated by socialization. Part of that is motivated by parties trying to mobilize people. The other piece to that is that we don't really have a huge part of our of the American bloc that votes. We don't have mandatory voting like we have in other countries. We have a single-member district plurality system that reinforces a two-party system. So you have a lot of folks who just feel like neither party is really what their priorities are or a configuration of policies that they really support. And so the result is we just have people that don't turn out. So for instance, when we talk about presidential elections, in the 2016 turnout rate was 55.6%. Which is pretty standard. I mean, we have a high of 62.77 percentage voter turnout rate, and that was back in 1960. The lowest turnout rate we've ever had in modern times since the 60s was about 49%. And so we only have about half the American electorate that actually turn out in any given election. And when we talk about midterm elections, it's even lower, right, about 30%. So generally, a lot of Americans just don't find voting to be the thing that is necessary to do or important enough to do, or is just not in their view of what they need to do.
Situate America in the broader international political process. What is unique about presidential elections in America compared to elections in the rest of the world?
The core part of that is, that we have this electoral college, which means that we don't have a popularly elected president. Instead, that we have folks who have to get a majority of this body of electors. The winner-take-all system, of course, has a little bit of a effect in which you can have wins and losses magnified in really significant ways that we don't see in most other nations that tend to run their elections by more of a popular vote process. In the sense that you have an institution like a Congress or a legislature that's electing a prime minister, so that you know that the majority party is going to be capturing that institution, the executive institution, or it's a clear popular vote. The Electoral College is very unique to the United States. And for the most part, it works out that the popular vote matches, but not always. It's very much that state-to-state effect that has that has to be looked at, and people who can't campaign on that basis also.
Mary Beth Sandell is new to our faculty here and brings almost 20 years of media expertise and experience in covering news from Stockholm, London, Zurich, New York, and D.C., where she worked with Bloomberg as a bureau chief, news trainer, and editor at large. Her B.A. is from the University of Wisconsin, and M.A.T.C., Masters of Arts in Technology and Communication, is from Chapel Hill. She lives in Pinehurst with her Swedish husband and bilingual middle school-aged girls. Mary Beth, how are you doing?
I'm good. Good to see you, Jeff.
Take us into the world of the media and let us see inside the news gathering process and the way elections are covered.
It's been very interesting to watch this last election because we've seen a lot of changes in how reporters and journalists cover elections over the last 40 to 50 years. And it's starting to unravel a little bit. And I think maybe one of the best ways to understand why it's unraveling is to look at actually how they gather their news and how they disseminate their news. So you've got two parts to the process. So say 40 years ago, a big newspaper like Washington Post or the New York Times would have local stringers and local reporters placed all over the United States. In every capital city, there would be one. And beyond the capital cities, there would be one. There would be local papers in every capital city, beyond every capital city. There would be more local papers than we have here. Now we just have the Robesonian, and we heard earlier this week how there were a number of other local papers in the area. And so reporters at the flagship national organizations would have all these resources to reach out into the country. But they'd also interview voters, you know, the traditional reporting and interviewing. They would interview the officials. They would interview the experts, and then they would have the polls, right? These would be their main sources of information. And they would go back to their office, and they would take all this information, organize it in their head, maybe make a few more phone calls, write down some notes, show it to their editor, and they would write their story, and it would be published. And then the next day, a reader would get the story printed, and they would read it. And then they might talk about it with their family or someone they work with. If they wanted to talk back to the reporter, they would have to write a letter to the editor. That would entail sitting down and writing a letter, taking it to the post office, right? And so that was how things went. You had time to think between each process. You knew what was going in. It was fairly organized. It was widespread. Today, things are a little bit different. Those stringers that were all over, those reporters that were in the Capitol buildings, they're not there. The newspapers that were all over town or all over the small towns, a lot of them are not there. And the ones that are there are not owned by the local families anymore. They're owned by the mass corporations, and they have much fewer reporters, and the news that they print is often written by someone somewhere else and sent down to them. They still interview the voters, and they still interview the officials. They interview the experts still, right? So that's all good. They do a lot of interviewing each other these days. If you've watched any news lately, there's a lot of reporters who don't have the time to get the expert on the phone, and so they'll ask another reporter who knows a lot because they've been following it, but then they get up there as experts. And we might later on talk about how that brings opinion into news, which is not the way I was raised to do it. And then they also rely on polls. And we might later get into a conversation about how the polls don't aren't perhaps as accurate as they were, don't measure in the same way. The methods of polling are different. The phones are different. The accessibility to people are different. And people seem to be less honest with the pollsters when they do ask them questions. So you've got a whole bunch of issues with the polls.
Now everybody that has a phone or a social media account fancies themselves as a reporter, bringing the...
Well, and then so that's on the dissemination side. So they take all that information, they go back to the newsroom. Well, someone's already reported it, so they've got to hurry, get it into the editor, send it to the paper, which is also digital first, print it, send it out. And it goes to the reader, and it goes to not just one reader, it goes to all readers. And guess what? They can all talk back immediately. And they can not only talk back so that you see it as the reporter, everyone else who is reading sees they're talking back. So they talk back to the reporter, they talk back to the editor, they talk to each other. Everyone else can talk to each other over the reporter, under the reporter. They can take their conversations somewhere else so the reporter doesn't know what those conversations are and have them offline somewhere else. And there's all this competition. So you have the blogs, the websites, the other places where it's easy to write, and they may not follow the same rules of accuracy, transparency, and value of word choice that a traditional reporter has or a traditional news agency has. And that's just thrown up a whole bunch of things into the air and made this election very messy.
Okay, so you described kind of two different processes, one more traditional, one more recent.
One was just 30 years ago.
Just 30 years ago. So take your reporter hat off and put your expert hat on. Which of these two, the older system or the current changes, has done a better job of helping us to elect solid candidates, and which of the two has made for a more informed voter?
I'm not sure you could say either is better than the other. I mean, it depends on how much you want everything to be black and white or how much you enjoy living in the gray area. It depends how much you want to think for yourself, how much you can think for yourself. So the old system was very organized, and what was given to you was what a reporter and an editor decided to give to you. And when things were streamlined, maybe that was just fine because there was this inherent trust in that they would give you all the news that's fit to print accurately, correctly, immediately. Today you get more information, right? That's good. Everyone says more information is good. But we've lost the how do you filter what's true and what's not true and what certain words mean and other words mean. So we might be richer in information. I'm not sure we're smarter.
That's good stuff right there.
We'll return to 30 Brave Minutes in a moment. Thank you for listening and for your financial support of the College of Arts and Sciences. If you want to support students and to help make events and programs like this one possible, please consider a contribution to the College of Arts and Sciences Dean's Fund. The fund exists to help students and faculty make meaningful connections to the community, the state, the region, and beyond through intellectual inquiry, research, and scholarship in the humanities, social sciences, and STEM fields. Mark your envelope, the Dean's Fund, College of Arts and Sciences, UNC Pembroke, Hickory Hall, Pembroke, North Carolina, 28372, or call the College of Arts and Sciences at 910-521-6198. You can also find us on the web. And now, back to 30 Brave Minutes, and your host, Jeff Frederick.
Emily?
So I would love to piggyback on something that Mary Beth was talking about, which is polling. And one of the things that I think is really important for people to recognize when they're looking at the coverage from the elections is a lot of the predictions that we saw that were reported as if it was polling was actually polling plus forecasting, which is a whole different ballgame. And so you have outlets like 538, very, you know, well-reputed forecasting site that was engaged in forecasting, and a lot of their predictions were talked about as if it was polling. Well, polling was only one facet of that, but the other facet is predicting who turns out, going back to those voter turnout pieces, and looking at past elections to sort of figure out who can we predict when we poll people? What's the likelihood of our rural voter turning out versus our urban voter, and what kind of urban voters turn out versus what kind of rural voters? And then weighting what we find in polls based on those predictions of what's happened in the past. And what we find is in this election cycle, pollsters just got it wrong about who would be turning out. And so part of you know, when we're trying to figure out, you know, everyone was saying Clinton was going to win, and it was just so off. I mean, not just off by a little bit, but way off when we start looking at the Electoral College count. Part of that was because it's not just pure polling that's getting reported, but this polling plus forecasting that I think a lot of people are not aware of. So.
Why don't each of you take a presidential election that you think it was particularly critical, either from changing the way your area of expertise has unfolded afterwards, or just that you think it was particularly noteworthy for the future of the country or the changes in the country?
Well, what surprises me, or doesn't surprise me, what strikes me in this discussion is how Mary Beth and Emily have been talking about polling and reaching out to voters and informing voters. And when I think back to the first presidential elections, those weren't primary concerns of political leaders. They subscribe to a more deferential style of politics where the upper echelons of society would make these decisions on behalf of society. They didn't campaign like people campaign today. In fact, they frowned upon campaigning because they were very suspicious of power, and they believed that people who campaigned wanted power and craved power and could be corrupted by power. And therefore, you did it more out of your service to community than your own personal aggrandizement.
Anyone who actually wants the job of president is probably not fit to have it.
That's right. Or at least he has to act like he doesn't want it. So that was very different. And
that changes?
Well, I think the election of 1828 is really important because it marks the rise of Andrew Jackson, who, while not much different than the other political elites of society, was from a very different background. He was supposedly the first president born in a log cabin, which I don't know if it's true, but he certainly did come from more humble circumstances and from an element of society that typically did not hold the higher offices. And when he won that election, his presidency was so controversial that an opposition party emerged, the Whig Party. And what you see in subsequent elections is the democratization to some degree of American politics. And rather than political elites ruling on behalf of the people, more and more they were reaching out and trying to draw the common people, and by that I mean the common white male people, into the political process. And so in the mid to late antebellum period, you see the first campaign biographies emerging and the use of campaign slogans and campaign buttons and stump speeching as a way of bringing people into the process. So they actually achieve very high participation by voters. It's just that voters were confined to a very limited segment of the population.
And those newly enfranchised and interested voters, when their candidate won, they expected something for it. And in Jackson's case, in 1828, they descend on the White House.
That's right.
And have essentially a rip-roaring keg party.
That's right.
On the White House lawn, purportedly so nasty that Jackson climbs out of a second-story window in order to escape the throng of well-wishers who showed there.
That's right.
What about the rest of y'all? Pick an election that you think was particularly transformative for one reason or another.
Transformative, generally, I would say a lot of political scientists would look at the 1968 election and not so much from the general, but from the perspective that the Democratic Party's nomination process had long-standing effects that transformed the way we think about primaries and the selection process generally. A lot of those choices is what kind of left a lot of the bad taste for this election cycle, especially when we talk about, well, on both sides, really, because you had a lot of you had on the Democratic side, the establishment folks who were making sure their establishment candidate was selected. I mean, the reality was, is Bernie Sanders was the outside. He was an independent for many years. He was not an established Democratic candidate. And so you had a lot of folks who had the same frustration as in the Democratic Party that we had in the 68 election, which was, how is it that outsiders can get a fair shot in running in the primary election? And should that be allowed in the first place, right? Those are normative questions that parties have to do soul searching about. On the flip side, right, even though it was the Democrats who had that soul-searching moment, it's not long after that election cycle, as the Democratic Party reforms their process, that the Republican Party also introduces a lot of those reforms that normalizes elections as the primary way that we select candidates in the primary process. And I think Republicans were also sort of facing the reality of that choice, of those choices, as you have the establishment folks who are trying to figure out, how do we get this outsider out of, right, out of the system, you know? And you hear that with the Never Trumpers that came out as a result. So we see a lot of those themes that were started in the 68 election, I think, being revisited this time, which is, what is the role of party and candidate selection? And is it really truly a Democratic endeavor, or is it a party endeavor? And that's a hard question, I think, for Americans to do soul searching over.
And both 68 and 2016 have a series of social and cultural changes that have become assimilated, and you have a series of actions and reactions either in support or in opposition to those. So I think that's an excellent choice. On the media side, 1960 is usually thought of as the seminal election.
I was going to come much more closer to today, since my colleagues have gone a little bit more into the past and stick in my comfortable zone of communications. I do think the 2008 election with Obama really opened up the world of how social media can play a role in elections and information like we've never seen before. The way they mobilized social media in emailing campaign, and the way they came into the White House and opened up their own website and made it really open for the people to petition collectively on that site and get a response from the White House right immediately to the people. That was a major change for us as voters. And then, you know, coming back to the polling issue, because I do, Emily, like that conversation a lot. You know, as recently as, what was it, 2014, the congressional election in between the two? I mean, we did see then how these pollsters / forecasters and all of their faults got it wrong before. We were expecting something different in that election, and it wasn't what it was. And so today you hear a lot of people say, well, how could the media have gotten this wrong? How the media is terrible. And I think, well, we got Hurricane Matthew wrong. I mean, we just relied on the best information that came to us. You can't blame them for it. But at the same time, there were some earlier indications that these polls that we used to rely on a lot maybe aren't as good as we thought they were. Something's changing and they're not keeping up. We saw that in that congressional election, and we just now got it confirmed in this one. So, you know, we didn't learn that lesson.
You know, the media is often accused of sort of horse race journalism, to where the polls become the lead story or above the fold in what's left of the American printed newspapers. Does the media deserve that indictment, that they're more interested in who's winning and who's losing than they are in the policy or the different issues presented by candidates?
You know, I haven't heard it put quite that way, but I would say that there is a lot of concern that the media or their owners are more interested in the clickbait headlines that get the readers than they are in the content of the. There's less concern about word choice and accuracy than there is getting there first and getting those clicks that you can sell ads against. And that's a big concern for all of us who've been raised as traditional journalists as we change into this new world. How do you keep journalism as something that's valuable if you're going to sell clicks?
I would just like to piggyback on that. The idea of electability being such a huge piece, right, in voter calculus, and that obsession with electability, I don't think is just media driven, but in some way is that the focus on polls in the horse race piece fulfills this sort of other need. And I think that that's what you're getting at, in the sense that it is driven sort of by what consumers are wanting. And that's, you know, there's always sort of been this concern that there's a lot of folks who are concerned about who's electable, in the sense of, when I'm trying to decide who to vote for, I want to make sure that I'm on the winning team, for lots of different reasons why people have that calculus. But I think that also does not help.
And, you know, parties understand that, and since 1828 or so, the parties have been critical in organizing and creating opportunities, sometimes courting media, sometimes creating media, sometimes exploiting media, and sometimes, you know, it goes the other way as well. How important is party identity? If you're a Republican, are you going to vote for the Republican no matter who they nominate? If you're a Democrat, are you going to vote for the Democrat no matter who they take yourselves into the mind of the voter? What causes someone to leave party behind?
I think historically we see that people's party affiliation does not change much over time, and that children tend to vote like their parents. And so you see a lot of consistency over generations, and it usually takes a cataclysmic event like the Great Depression, for instance, to create large-scale shifts in voting patterns.
The parties have obviously changed and realigned some over time, regionally and by issue. How has that been kickstarted by campaigns themselves, or has it been more internal dynamics? What it means to be a Republican now is not what it would have meant to have been a Republican, you know, 100 years ago, certainly maybe not even 50. Same thing on the Democratic side.
Well, I mean, that's true, right? We do have voting realignment elections, and there's a robust literature that we can talk about that. And they are usually connected to some kind of big event that causes that realignment and that reexamination. But as far as modern times, that choice about leaving the party, our parties are pretty consistent. But you have to remember, about a third of the American public identifies as independent. Now, a lot of political scientists will say that one third is not totally being honest, because many of them are Democratic-leaning, are fairly predictable Democratic voters, or Republican-leaning, they're predictable Republican voters, even though they tend to identify as independent over time. And we see that with this election, that there's a lot of folks who were, you know, even kind of in the predictions from our folks who do forecasting that Clinton was going to win. What we find is when we actually look at turnout rates, Republican turnout rates were pretty consistent, right? We had about the same people voting Republican in this election that we had in previous elections. What we seem to see is that there was a decrease in Democratic turnout. So not necessarily party flipping, but essentially, but the choice about whether I stay at home or whether I go to vote seems to be a bigger part of the calculus of who wins in flipping elections between presidential and presidential level between Democrats and Republicans.
There's a difference between being a great campaigner and a highly effective president. You know, some of our most effective campaigners would include people even like William McKinley, Teddy Roosevelt, who was such an interesting campaigner in one election. He got shot and still continued to speak. Franklin Roosevelt, obviously, in 1932, is a highly effective campaigner. Harry Truman, even in 1948, a highly effective campaigner from sort of coming out of nowhere. Ronald Reagan, a highly effective campaigner. Bill Clinton, a highly effective campaigner. Not all of them would necessarily be in the ranks of some of the top presidents in terms of how scholars tend to rank them. Do campaign skills translate to actually administering the government, or are they really two different skill sets?
There's a lot of skills that are not really translatable. I mean, at the end of the day, being an effective president takes significantly more in a more diverse set of skills than campaigning alone does. But I think there are some skills you could argue are translatable in the sense that being effective at persuading is a very important skill. Being able to manipulate the circumstances such that people will see your side, I think, is a skill that you see in both negotiating as a president as well as in campaigning. I think the problem is there's a whole slew of additional skills that are not necessarily vetted very well with the campaign process.
What comes to mind for me is the election of 1960, in which John Kennedy won one of the closest elections in American electoral history, and it's the first election that had televised debates, and Kennedy was very effective in those televised debates, And those people who watched the debates on TV tended to conclude that Kennedy won, and those who listened to it on the radio tended to think Richard Nixon won. Kennedy was considered to be a handsome, dashing figure. He was very effective on television and looked at the screen and seemed to be talking directly to the American people and engaging the American people in a way that Richard Nixon just didn't understand at that time. And so that was an important election, showing the power of television and the power of image, maybe over substance.
I think that's a great anecdote, because I was thinking in my head, there is a difference between being an effective president and being liked. Mm-hmm. And just because you're one doesn't mean you're the other. And we should remember to keep those different as we do this measuring as we go on.
Let's end on this. Since about maybe 1968 or so coming forward, the media have started to become criticized pretty regularly for intentionally shaping their coverage to one side or another, particularly after Walter Cronkite announces that the Vietnam War can't be won. People sort of from a different political perspective began to see the media as less reporting news and more trying to make news. Mary Beth, you get us started on this. Is that a reasonable complaint? Because it's made by people on both sides that the media is biased and slanted in trying to shape outcomes. This is your chance to stand up for the profession.
Well, I don't think it's that easy. I do think that there is more opinion that's come into reporting and writing than I'm comfortable with, less so in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times than, say, the Huffington Post. So you have to define media and define journalism before you get there. And at some point, the scale goes from, yes, big journals with a capital J to blog. And there's a whole bunch of stuff in between, right? And so where do you slide that scale? I printed out a story that I read the other day that someone posted about Trump's new chief strategist, and the lead uses verbs like seems and hinted and appears. And these are words that make me cringe as an editor, because if you can't show what you're going to report, then don't say it at all, because then it's your opinion. And we talk about that in class a lot. But at the same time, I do think there are many very, very good journalists out there who are accurate, who are fair, who do stick with the facts. And there's a group of folks who want to throw doubt on that. And there's enough of a reason to consider the doubt that it gets spread to those who don't deserve it. And so I think with this world of over information that we have right now, the onus is going to be on the consumer to figure out how to build their filter antennas and understand who's giving them the truth and who's not. And that's what we're all struggling with right now.
I think that's a very good point. What is the media has become a much more complicated issue, and what is the news has become a much more complicated issue. And we who are a little grayer in the hair and longer in the tooth see a difference today than what we saw 20 years ago or 30 years ago. People who are new to the process, they, I think, have a hard time distinguishing what is news from what is a more of a news-related editorial entertainment show. So the differences have become blurred.
Yeah, blurred lines all over the political process, from the way we campaign to the way we expect our candidates to govern to the way we report and analyze the news. Well, that's all our time that we have for today. I want to thank Emily and Mary Beth and Mark for their wise and sage counsel on the American presidency. Thanks to all of those who are listening, and please pass 30 Brave Minutes along to someone else. And tune in next month for another discussion from the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of North Carolina at Pembroke.
Today's podcast was produced by Dr. Richard Gay and transcribed by Ms. Janet Gentis. Theme music created by Riley Morton. This content is copyrighted by the University of North Carolina and the College of Arts and Sciences. It is to be used for educational and non-commercial purposes only, and is not to be changed, altered, or used for any commercial endeavor without the express written permission of authorized representatives of the University of North Carolina at Pembroke. The views and opinions expressed by any individuals during the course of these discussions are their own and do not necessarily represent the views, opinions, and positions of the University of North Carolina at Pembroke or any of its subsidiary programs, schools, departments, and divisions. While reasonable efforts have been made to ensure that information discussed is current and accurate at the time of release, neither UNCP nor any individual presenting material makes any warranty that information presented in the original recording has remained accurate due to advances in research, technology, or industry standards. Thanks for listening to 30 Brave Minutes, and go Braves!